with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson and Travis Dansel. Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow morning on the program, once again, we'll be dipping into the Focus 580 archives. Both interviews have to do with history. In the first hour, we'll be talking a bit about English history, and in the second, about American. In the first hour, the guest is Danny Danziger. He's co-author of a book entitled 1215. The year of the Magna Carta, which looks at the creation and the signing of that document, signed by King John, who was forced by his nobles that he enraged them so they forced him to sign a piece of paper limiting his own power. He died shortly after that, but that paper went on and inspired a lot of other people, among them the authors of the Declaration of Independence. So in this conversation from June, we talk a little bit about the historical background to the Magna Carta and also talk about what life was like in England at that time in the year 1215. So that's what you'll hear in the 10 o'clock hour. In the 11 o'clock hour tomorrow, another archive from June, and the guest there is Paul Starr. He teaches at Princeton University, and he's written a book that looks at the creation of the media in the United States and how it is that American media tends to be organized very differently from media of other countries. He makes this argument that, in fact, the American Revolution set the United States on a path to develop communications that diverged very sharply from patterns in Europe. And he says that the way that communications developed in this country does have, certainly it has to do with economic issues and technological ones, but that can't explain it exclusively. He says you have to look at political ideas. So the book is entitled The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communications. And if you did not hear that first time around, on June 7th, you will have the chance tomorrow morning on the program. And then next week, on Monday, we'll be getting back kind of to our regular schedule. We'll be back here live, and we'll be taking your calls. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the commission investigating the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Recently presented its final report. It's still being discussed and no doubt will be discussed for some time. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Stephen Strasser. He teaches journalism at Rutgers University and also for a number of years worked for Newsweek magazine. He was a foreign correspondent, national affairs editor, and also managing editor of the international editions of Newsweek. And he is the editor of a book that's recently been published that brings together the staff reports of the 9/11 Commission. They're available also, of course, on the Commission's website. And if you heard some of the live coverage that we had here on AM 580 of some of the Commission hearings, you heard members of the staff reading these reports, or at least excerpts from them. And if you would like to read them in detail, you can look for this book. It's entitled The 9/11 Investigations, which also includes some excerpts from the House-Senate Joint Inquiry Report on 9/11, and then testimony from a number of key witnesses, including Richard Clark, George Tenet, and Condoleezza Rice. It's published by Public Affairs, and it is available in paperback, so it's not terribly expensive, and you should be able to find it in the bookstore right now. But, of course, questions are welcome here on the same subject. Here on the program, here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois or Indiana. In fact, if you'd happen to be listening on the internet, you can use the number, just as long as you're in the United States, and that's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Strasser, hello.
Hello, How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And we certainly appreciate it. Just so the people can understand what it is we're talking about here, the if people watched some of the hearings or listened, we broadcast them, and I'm sure a lot of other public stations did broadcast at least parts of them. Now, the public face of the commission are the commissioners, Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton and the others, including one of our former governors, Jim Thompson. Those are the people that got the most attention. They went around and did interviews and talked to people on the talk shows and so forth. But what we're talking about here is the work of people that were not so high profile as the commission, and yet I think pretty important to the work of the commission. Maybe you can talk about a little bit about how these staff reports were generated and what kind of people were responsible for doing this research.
Well, fortunately for us, there were a lot of writerly people involved. They included the kinds of researchers you'll see on congressional staffs. There were lawyers and investigators, in some cases people with former police backgrounds who were added to the staff for investigations. They received a lot of cooperation, especially as time went on, from the administration itself. So the administration would second people from the agencies or the State Department and Pentagon to help put together material for these reports. And at the top of them was a group of people with publishing experience. And I might say that one of the features of these reports, compared to any other government report you might have read in your life, is that they're extremely well written. That's at the root of our decision to put this book together.
Well, if you look at this material and also at the final report that the commission released, it seems that different people have different sorts of reactions to it. Some people think that it was well done. Other people think that it doesn't go far enough, and particularly in its criticism of the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the FBI, the CIA, and so forth. And certainly there is criticism there for all of them. Is it, I don't know, do you feel like making some kind of a judgment about how just how significant and how far-reaching the final result is?
My judgment is about the nature of the report itself, and I think they did a wonderful job. I think that Governor Kaine, Representative Hamilton reflect an earlier era when politicians of either the Republican or Democratic Party could find consensus, especially on a matter of national security or national crisis in this case. And I think they brought together this commission, which did include an equal number of Republicans and Democrats, and came up with a consensus report, which I think was quite hard-hitting. So, yes, there are compromises. Perhaps some people think they didn't hit the Bush administration hard enough, and the same could be said about the Clinton administration. But I think they did come up with a remarkably good consensus and a better report than has been produced by these kinds of commissions in the past.
Mm-hmm. The chair and the co-chair, Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton, were not the first choice for that job. There were a couple of other much more high-profile names that were put out there who then subsequently decided that they couldn't or wouldn't be involved. How did they end up with Governor Kaine and Congressman Hamilton as being the number one and number two guys on this commission?
Well, they did go through some other names. I think the main problem was the main name that gave them problems was Henry Kissinger's. When you think of Henry Kissinger, divisions spring up in a dinner party or at a reception or in the nation. There are people who think he was a brilliant strategist, and there are people who think that he was an evil manipulator behind the scenes who brought down innocent governments around the world and caused untold human anguish. So everybody has an opinion. You love him or you hate him. And I think they didn't want – I think after the storm broke over Kissinger, they just decided they didn't want to go that way. They didn't want to have a personality who was renowned for causing divisiveness at the head of this commission. no matter how talented he would have been at actually putting a report together and organizing the commission's work. So they turned to Kane, who was a consensus man, a very moderate Republican who had gotten along equally with Republicans and Democrats in New Jersey, which is basically a Democratic state.
What would you say were the so obviously we're talking about the commission having generated an awful lot of information, and the staff reports, for example, looked at all phases of the terrorist attack of 9/11, how it is the hijackers got here, why it is that their presence here wasn't identified, or if somebody got the idea that there was some reason to be suspicious, somehow it never went beyond that person and their agency. There was bad coordination between the various agencies who were concerned with security issues. And it looks at the attack and how it happened, and it looked at the response, and a very wide range of information. But as you, and now you've had the opportunity to look at all of this, what would you say, and then perhaps we can go back and we can talk in some detail, were the most important findings of the commission?
Well, there were, of course, the newsworthy findings. They proposed a director of national intelligence. They proposed that the budgets for the disparate intelligence agencies be brought under his control. And they proposed an umbrella counterterrorist center that would try to bring the information flow from all these intelligence agencies under control. That was the basic underlying message, the policy recommendations of the commission. They, of course, also made strong points, as commentators like Fareed Zakaria have noted, about the need for the United States to take a more comprehensive approach in its relations with the Middle East, to solve our problems in just getting along with that part of the world and understanding it and helping it join the world that that we belong to, so that we it doesn't become a hotbed of terrorism, that doesn't remain a hotbed of terrorism.
Well, it seemed that one of the key points that certainly caused a lot of conversation was the issue of what was there in the way of state support for the hijackers? One of the big questions that there has been hotly debated, for example, was the government of Iraq at all involved? Also, more recently, there have been questions raised about whether there was any funding for the hijackers from Saudi sources. Most of them were Saudis. And then even more recently, there was this question about Iran and the fact that apparently some of the hijackers may have passed through Iran, and that the Iranian government had at least made it easy for them to do that. I don't think anybody has drawn a line between that and September 11th. But there were all these questions raised about did these governments, or were there any governments involved? And does it seem that the bottom line answer to all those questions, at least as far as the commission is concerned, is no? None of those governments did indeed were specifically involved in the 9/11 plot?
I would say that's correct. Maybe not a strict no, but an apparently not. Mm-hmm. For example, the commission did note that various members of these terrorist teams had passed through Iran, but it made no judgment about whether the Iranians were facilitating this because they were part of the plot, or whether they were just facilitating this because they, shall we say, agreed with the politics of the operatives. So they didn't find any Iranian support. They didn't find any Saudi state support. They concluded that Iraq did not support the terrorists. There had been meetings about cooperation, but nothing ever developed. There also, the United Arab Emirates is a big player in this. A lot of the financing flowed through the United Arab Emirates. So there are certainly lots of national connections, but there's no solid evidence that the commission has received that any governments were involved.
The Bush administration has been criticized for trying to, here's the way I think people lay it out. They would say the Bush administration never did say directly in so many words that Saddam Hussein was somehow involved in the plot of 9/11. But in a lot of the public pronouncements about the war on terror, the those things are always mentioned together, not directly connected. But the criticism of the administration has been is that what they're trying to do is get people in their minds to make that association without the administration coming right out and saying it. The commission, the 9/11 commission, I think, came out and made a very strong statement saying that they didn't believe that there was any connection between al-Qaeda and the government of Saddam Hussein. It seemed, though, that after that, some people in the administration were still saying, well, maybe, or that there is some evidence, or that you can't rule it out. They're still wanting to make that suggestion that, well, there might be some, or that we know about it, but we can't exactly tell you what. What do you think about that assertion that the commission made, pretty strong assertion, saying, no, there just is no evidence of an active relationship going on between the government of Iraq under Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda?
Well, I trust what the commission says. They're independent. They did extremely good work. Nothing they've said has really been questioned by the administration so far. And I think that they very thoroughly investigated the idea of connections between Saddam and al-Qaeda and came up with that conclusion. Same on the weapons. I mean, David Kay was appointed as a weapons inspector by the Bush administration. He thoroughly reviewed every nook and cranny of the country after the U.S. invasion with U.S. support, while the U.S. controlled everything on the ground. And he says any idea that Iraq was sheltering weapons of mass destruction is a dream. So I tend to give a lot of credence to both those authorities.
The specific charge to the commission was to investigate the attack of 9/11, not to get into the whole issue of was it right to go to war in Iraq. However, that was a subject that continued to come up, and you just couldn't get away from because of there were certainly connections, and yet I think the commission continued to say, no, look, this was saying anything about Iraq. This was not what we were supposed to do. Having said that, I wonder if you have any sort of feeling that there was some inclination on the commission to actually get into that more than they did, or were they just perfectly happy not to be able to say this is not our agenda because that just would have made things that much more complicated?
I think their goal was to look very critically at all aspects of 9/11, as you say. And by critically, I mean critically. They came into New York, where a lot of firemen and police officers had died, and they made a point of being polite, respectful, but very critical of the way New York handled the crisis day itself, including the communications between the police and fire departments. So I think this commission was determined to keep focused on 9/11, to keep focused on its mission to find out what went wrong. They weren't there to put a gloss on things. They were there to find out what went wrong. And I think they were happy not to drag in Iraq and issues that were peripheral to them. There was an amusing moment when Richard Clark showed up for his second or third round of testimony at the commission after he had made all his charges about Bush improperly going to war in Iraq. And somebody said, well, why didn't you bring this up before? And he said, well, you didn't ask me.
We have a caller. We'd welcome other folks if you'd like to get into the conversation. Let me again introduce our guest, Stephen Strasser. He's now teaches journalism at Rutgers University. He is a former foreign correspondent and editor at Newsweek, and he is the editor of a book titled The 9/11 Investigations, which brings together the staff reports from the 9/11 Commission, also some of the House-Senate Joint Inquiry Report, parts of that, and also some testimony from some of the most important witnesses who appeared before the 9/11 Commission. It's published by Public Affairs. It's in paper. It is in the bookstore now if you'd like to look at it. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller on our toll-free line in Aurora. We'll go there, line number 4. Hello.
I'd like to go back to 1993. That was the first time that the World Trade buildings were attacked, wasn't it? 1993?
Yes.
What was done then in any way to possibly not have what happened at 9/11? Was there anything put in to effect then so 9/11 wouldn't happen?
Well, that was a sensational and violent attack, and it killed, I believe, fewer than 10 people and injured hundreds, and, of course, caused a royal mess in downtown New York. But, you know, security measures were put in after that, largely in the form of increased security personnel, better alarm system, and procedures for evacuating and handling a crisis in the World Trade Center that hadn't existed before. But I have to say, and I think perhaps a lot of New Yorkers would agree with me, that at its base, that attack was considered something of a joke. These guys drove a van full of explosives into the World Trade Center and thought they were going to tip it over onto the neighboring tower and bring them both down. And every architecture and engineer in the city got up and said that was ridiculous and impossible. And basically, this was a futile attack. So the attack itself, as a manifestation of what to expect from terrorists, was not taken as seriously as it should have been. The guy they arrested for that attack, Ramzi Youssef, at one point, in fact, he was flying into New York for a court appearance, and the FBI agent accompanying him pointed at the World Trade Center and said, "It's still standing." And Ramzi Youssef said, "We'll be back." And they did come back.
Oh, my.
They did come back, and we didn't take it seriously.
Well, that is one element that I saw watching it. I was watching TV when it happened at 8:45 my time. And the people, there didn't seem to be an alarm system in effect, was there?
Yes, there was.
People didn't know how, it seemed to me, to be going out of the building.
Oh, there were 10,000 people in the World Trade Center that morning. The alarm system worked perfectly. After the they had no capabilities to fight a fire above the 80th floors where the plane struck, but the people below that, in the North Tower, which was struck first, evacuated very quickly and efficiently.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't that big of a problem. One of the problems is that in order to try to save people from falling debris, security in the South Tower ordered people to go back to their offices, saying there's no danger here. Then,
yes,
of course,
and I remember hearing that. And
yeah,
I,
then the second plane hit the South Tower.
I guess it wasn't really, we weren't capable of realizing what they could be doing. We just, I think, refused to believe that could really be happening to us.
That's what Governor Kaine said in his when he announced the commission's final findings, that the main problem here was our lack of imagination. We just didn't imagine that something like this could happen.
Yes, it's a very sad thing. And do you think there is any way I understand about what has been worked on I think that there are terrorists in now is a thing that is, I want to say new but not new, but we have to understand how a terrorist's mind is, and that's what we have to imagine, what their mind is, that what they're capable of thinking. You know, they don't care if they die.
Yeah, well, I can make two remarks on that. One is to reflect what the commission said about our need to understand that part of the world better and understand their resentments of us better. And several witnesses to the commission, most eloquently Madeleine Albright, made that same point. So, I mean, that's certainly a very strong aspect of it.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you. Just for a moment, I want to go back to you know, to the comment that Governor Kaine made about when he was introducing the final report, talking about the fact that maybe one of the great failures here was a failure of imagination. And certainly Condoleezza Rice, for example, has been, she said now famously, and as a quote, I'm sure that it has been repeated over and over again, said something to the effect of, no one could have imagined that terrorists would hijack a commercial airliner and use it as a missile to fly into the building. And in a press conference that President Bush had, he essentially echoed that over and over again. He stood there in front of the reporters and the American people and said, if we had known that terrorists were going to hijack an airplane and fly it into the World Trade Center, we would have done something about it. And I'm sure everybody, of course, believes that. Well, of course they would. But that does raise this question that, well, is it really the case that no one imagined that such a thing could happen? And it would seem that that in its inquiries, the commission really called that into question, because apparently there were people who did imagine such a thing could have happened.
Well, there had been previous cases. There was a case where Algerian hijackers tried to fly a plane into the Eiffel Tower, I believe, in the 1990s. There was another case where American intelligence picked up word of a terrorist group in the Middle East trying to fly a plane across the Atlantic to strike an American building, which there's something that couldn't happen. Our defenses pointing out the sea were working quite well. There were reports like that. There was the other, of course, the Bojinka plot, which involved blowing up planes over the Pacific, but people involved in that plot also had an idea of hijacking a plane and crashing into the CIA headquarters. So this idea was out there. It hadn't penetrated to the point where it was made a part of our preparations for terrorist attacks.
We have some other callers here to talk with. Let's go next to someone listening in Indiana this morning, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Two things. One, when Governor Kaine started speaking, I can't exactly remember who it was, but he made the comment, we may be washed out politicians. Then he said something about we did our best and did a good job. I never heard anything in the news about who had called them washed out politicians, but I presume it was some Republican probably making a light of the commission's report and its importance and the caliber of the people who were on it. Then secondly, when the commission came out so strongly that there were actually no connections between al-Qaeda and Iraq, then President Bush said, well, there is, and that was sort of left, you know, a silence in the room. Nobody seemed to interested in asking him why. Then a couple days later, Putin come out with saying, oh, yeah, we had some, our Secret Service said that there were some connections. And I immediate thing came to mind, because I don't trust this administration anyway in any kind of thing, is that somehow Putin was put up to this, and particularly when he said that, you know, he was still against the war, you know, against what the war was. You know, it didn't ring right. I was wondering if you could make any comments about those two things. Thank you.
Well, I think Kaine was just making a lighthearted comment that reflected the fact that everybody on his commission, all the public members, were retired politicians or State Department, I guess Department of Justice administrators in one case. So they were all retirees who'd come out to chair this commission. I don't think there was anything more to it than that. As far as Putin's report, I saw that, but it's never really been followed up. And I must say it hasn't been followed up by columnists like Robert Novak, who normally would reflect, shall we say, the more untested allegations from inside the Bush administration in Washington. So I'm not sure whether Putin really meant what he said, or whether we understood what he meant, or whether there was any substance to it. I think if there was substance to it, then we would have seen a lot more details, because, of course, supports what Bush is saying about the connection.
Well, I appreciate the Caller's comments. Let's go on here. I have somebody else in Rantoul, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think one of the things that the whole thing was based on is that it would require an extensive amount of money and extensive amount of time to prepare for the 911 attacks. Anybody involved in U.S. military black operations would know that within hours you could put this together and get that done. Second thing, in looking at the report and reading the report, they talk about the preparation as far as New York and New Jersey Port and Police Authority and Emergency Service Unit. Back as far as 1995, and I know I was involved in it, they had received extensive counterterrorism and terrorism training very specifically for these types of incidents. And so all the warnings were out there. However, what had happened within the New York Emergency Services Unit and the police and fire, they, Rudolph Giuliani, despite numerous requests, their administration had not provided the equipment necessary for an effective response in the event of any situation. So, I mean, that's just kind of stuff that had popped up and happened in there. The real concern that I have, and it's been alluded to already numerous times, is the fact that nobody wanted to imagine all this was happening. But when in the community, counterterrorism discussions and all this stuff was extensively known, as far as using jets and aircraft and everything to take out bombers and everything, Dale Brown had written up extensively about that in a book called Storming Heaven. So it was all known. Again, the same thing even on the morning that it happened. The United Nations had put out messages that they'd put warning, putting all the warnings out, and the stuff was about ready to happen, but it was ignored. So I just wondered if the author could kind of comment on those, because it seems like, looking at the 911 Commission report and reading through it, they've just kind of glossed over a lot of stuff in order to continue on with this myth of Al-Qaeda, who does exist and who's been known to be dangerous. And again, the ESU unit in New York had known about them planning far back as 95 for them. So as long as the author could comment on some of these big missing gaps on this whole logical sequence.
Well, Mr. Strasser, can you do that?
Yes, I can. The planning for 9/11 stretched back to the middle of the 1990s, at a time when we thought that bin Laden was essentially a financier of terrorism. He actually heard the first proposals for something that became the 9/11 attacks. So it was really in the works for 6 years. And it is kind of daunting and it's kind of depressing to think that our intelligence agency wouldn't pick up a plan like this, this elaborate, that was this many parts occurring over this so many geographical areas, Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, and not pick it up before it actually happened. That is kind of depressing. As far as the New York, New Jersey preparations, those departments and departments all over the place, I'm sure in Champaign-Urbana, prepared for the millennium in a big way. And there was lots of training for that, for dealing with weapons of mass destruction, equipment given to local police departments, and that sort of thing. So people were expecting to live in an era where there'd be some kind of terrorism, but we keep getting back to this lack of imagination. They didn't imagine the kind of attack that actually occurred. When they thought of hijackings in the administration or in the Federal Aviation Administration for that matter, they thought of the traditional hijacking where a terrorist would take over a plane, park it somewhere, and sort of threaten to blow up everybody else unless one of his buddies got out of jail. That's the kind of context they looked at hijackings in.
I guess I disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You
mentioned some of the earlier cases, and there have been. You mentioned a book. There was a Tom Clancy book too, I guess, that related to crashing into buildings with airplanes. But
what the administration says
is they didn't really have that on their radar screen.
Well, it's just kind of, again, this is what they're coming up with saying, because, again, the whole justification and everything that's Al-Qaeda, when you look at digging into the actual reports, we still don't know who was actually involved, okay? And that's still been up inquiry. When we go back to the whole thing, launching...
Who was involved in terms of training the terrorists? That sort of
thing? I mean, training the terrorists and doing the training as far as preparation for an individual fly of those aircraft. I could take you up here to Chanute Octave Museum and put you into a bomber and teach you in about 20 minutes how to fly an aircraft sufficiently to do it. It's not that extensive. Mm-hmm. As far as black operations, to plan this type of an operation, you can do it within 2 hours, 3 hours easily. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that complicated. As far as all the warnings and everything, the warnings were definitely out there. You mentioned the equipment and supplies being provided. That's a total failure is one thing that's still going on. We can't get adequate equipment and supplies into the individuals, and the primary terrorist threat is not Al-Qaeda from outside. It's 15 to 16 from domestic organizations. So within this stuff, so again, it's the hype and hysteria. I think the really thing that really bothers me on this stuff is this whole thing launched, obviously launched into the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, okay? Both of them totally illegal. When we look at the invasion of Afghanistan, they need to have a justification because bin Laden, again, and that group were definitely, you know, supported by the U.S. military, and all their equipment and supplies were provided by General John A. Guest back in 1990, 91, and before. So, again, it comes down to where you go back to a February 12th of 1998 congressional directive to overthrow the Taliban and get some reason justification to get troops into Afghanistan to support the oil thing, the oil pipeline. So, I mean, that's cut and dry. I think the thing that disturbs me is how this thing has been twisted around where we have a real viable threat. It's been made into a serious, overblown hype and hysteria. Again, one group and everything, where it takes so much money and so much time to do this with anybody that's involved in military black operations, though you could plan and execute this sucker within 2 hours. It's that easy. And training the people to fly the aircraft, come on up here to Chanute, to the museum, and 20 minutes we'll have you flying a multi-engine jet sufficient to do it. It's that easy.
Well, I got a couple of other callers here. Mr. Strasser, any other comments you might want to make on what the caller had to say?
Well, I think that I guess the one basic comment I would make is that while there were plenty of warnings for before 9/11, they didn't have enough specificity to cause action. They were not actionable, which is the term always used as a commission. In other words, they would pick up radio conversations saying, our plan is tomorrow, the big act is coming, stuff like that. But none of those things said where or exactly when something was going to happen. So George Tenet, the director of the CIA, was running around pounding on tables in Washington, warning everybody that something was happening, but he couldn't say what, where, or when. And I think, you know, we were not prepared for it, but, you know, we tend to fight yesterday's wars. We're very prepared for any attack on aircraft tomorrow, but are we prepared for attacks on subways or, God knows, somewhere else?
Hmm. We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more like 15, in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Stephen Strasser. He teaches journalism at Rutgers University and was for a number of years on the staff at Newsweek. He's been a former foreign correspondent, national affairs editor, and also managing editor of the international editions of Newsweek. And he's the editor of a book that's just come out that brings together the staff reports of the 9/11 Commission, and it's titled The 9/11 Investigations. It's published by Public Affairs and is in bookstore now, if you want to look at it. We had a caller off the air who noted the fact that while the president and the vice president agreed to talk with members of the commission, it was behind closed doors. There was no record made of what they said, and they weren't required to take an oath. And I believe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that also former President Clinton and Vice President Gore did the same. The caller was wondering if there's any particular kind of precedent set by allowing people to appear before a commission like this and yet not requiring them to swear any kind of oath and not having any record of what it is that they said.
Well, I think they were willing to take the national leaders any way they could get them. They were able to talk to people like Condi Rice, who was the director of the National Security Council, and Richard Clark, who had been the anti-terrorism director under both Clinton and George W. Bush, in several forums. They talked to them privately. They talked to them in public forum. I believe in the case of the national leaders, Bush, Cheney, Clinton, Gore, they thought the most efficient use of their time and the most productive use of their time would be to get these guys behind the scenes, to get them to be as candid as possible. You're going to get, by a quantity of 10, more information in a private session with them than you are in public session. And as for the oath swearing and all of that, I think that's a matter of protocol. It's a matter of not requiring the chief executive to to appear in that kind of a situation when there's no question of illegality or anything like that.
Well, we have some other folks to talk with. Let's continue. We'll go to Champaign County and line number one. Hello.
Hi. It's kind of presumptive that you're saying there's no question of illegality. I mean, that's a moot point, I think, in a lot of people's minds. My understanding, and this isn't for sure, but that Clinton and Gore did give sworn testimony, but it hadn't been the practice of the committee to actually swear in many of their earlier witnesses, that it was only when the argument turned towards getting some of these high-level people in that they started doing that, and that the earlier people actually weren't. But going back and correcting the record on another thing, the caller called in with the remark about Putin, and you didn't catch it. Putin's digression after the release of the report, where they said there was no collaborative connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. Go back and check the record. It had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. He said that they had evidence that Iraq on its own was planning sabotage inside the U.S., an attack inside the U.S. in the lead-up to the attack on Iraq. That was pretty much a done deal. Coming, they could see it coming, sort of thing. I'm not apologizing for anybody in this instance, but that is the substance of what Putin said, and it was basically a huge digression because it really hadn't. It was kind of amazing in the reaction to it because. Anyway, going on, among other groups besides Tom Clancy that had the idea of the attack through commandeering a vehicle, like an airliner, was a Library of Congress report. So not a particularly high-level intelligence outfit, but, well, actually maybe higher level than many of the purportedly high-level outfits. I guess that's ironic. You're... assessment overall that this is a substantive kind of impartial thing is certainly not agreed to by a lot of people around the families. There's a number of groups, citizens, 911 Citizens Watch, other groups who are picking it apart and contesting it. And when you have someone like our neighboring state's representative, Hamilton on board. I mean, he was supposed to be getting to the bottom of Iran-Contra and kind of just walked away from it. John Kerry did more to study the Iran-Contra thing than Hamilton ever did. And he's an apparatchik. He's right inside the Beltway, and that's what a lot of people's assessments are, contrary to yours. So a lot of points there. I'll shut up a while.
Well, when we do have some other calls here, I guess I want to give the guest a chance. You want to respond to some of the comments the caller has?
Yes. He's right about swearing in. They started swearing in when he got to Washington and dealt with the serious policy issues. On Putin, now, I don't have that clip in front of me. All I know is what I read in the paper, but I could have sworn he was talking about that Russian intelligence had seen a connection between Saddam and weapons of mass destruction. I think that's what his leak was. Am I not right? Has he signed off?
Well, my apologies. I put him back on hold.
Okay. I'm pretty sure that's what they were indeed talking about. And as far as the families, they do strongly support the 9/11 Commission report, and I'm sure there are individuals who don't, but as a group, they're strongly supporting it, and they're behind the heavy pressure on the Bush administration to make sure that some of these get enacted.
We are getting short on time, and I have some other callers, and I just can't give the caller more time right now. I want to go ahead, though, and go to the next in line. We have someone in McLean County on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello, good morning. I'd just like to make a comment.
And I know it's a little off of the current discussion, but I remember the day 9/11 very well, and I was feeling extremely angry about the fact that it happened, and nobody seemed to talk about the fact that in 93 when the World Trade Center was bombed, I don't know why no one ever thought that they would come back again. And I'm just making a comment, and thank you for letting me speak it, because just listening to the conversation is starting to get me very angry again, because I still don't, and I just wish I could figure this out, why someone, and I hear what you're saying, and all the people, but it's like I don't understand why we have our heads buried in the sand when we're dealing with people who are fanatical, and we've been so thinking that we live in the U.S. and we have oceans on both sides and two sides and countries that are relatively, you know, friendly on north and south of us, nothing would happen to us. And anyway, so thank you for letting me speak my two cents.
Sure.
And have a good day.
All right, thank you. Well, anything, Mr. Schauser, you want to pick up on that at all?
Yes, I think we shouldn't beat ourselves up too badly over having missed this. I think there were signs. In retrospect, you can see a lot of evidence that could have been picked up on. You wish a couple more steps had been taken in some of these cases. It's right that we're reforming the intelligence system to make all these guys worry about us, to make more people worry about this kind of terrorist potential. But I think we're just stronger as a country after all this happened to us. I think we're not going to be surprised and shocked and dismayed about what happens now. We're going to be much more effective in dealing with this in the future and responding to potential problems and hunting these guys down. There's nowhere for the, maybe there was a place for them to hide before. There's no place for them to hide now. And I just feel more optimistic. New York is doing pretty well these days, and I just think that something, even if something did happen here tomorrow, I think we'd respond to it with much more spirit and much more forthrightness and direction and much more quickly than we did after 9/11.
Let's go on to another caller. This person is in Charleston, and it's line number two. Hello.
Yes. Do you perceive that 9/11 and other events for 200 years of modern times on both sides of these events that happen in a vacuum? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Complete your point.
Well, there are two sides to every story.
Yes.
And so far we've heard only one. Therein lies the crux of the matter. People respond. It's like any bullyism that extends around the world. The bully takes the territory, but he doesn't have eyes in the back of his head. And sooner or later, those who are oppressed by the bully will respond. Hence, no vacuum.
Well, that's very Aesopian, but what's your point about the other
side?
Do you think
those airplanes were flown into those buildings just because someone woke up one day and said, let's go get them? No, I mean, there's a history behind all that stuff. And our incursions into the Arab and the Islamic world, into Africa, followed on the heels of the British who preceded us. Think of all the travails of India, you know, where when dynamite was discovered, then they went to work with it. I mean, what happened to diplomacy and to fairness and to honesty and all the other things that exist in this world to prevent things like 9/11? When Ronald Reagan had all those people in Lebanon, you know, did those boys die for nothing? Did the people that drove that little truck in there with all those explosives on it, were they just getting up something to do that day? I mean, it is just occurs to me that those things are dealt with in a manner that is conducive to the behavior of the parties involved.
Well, you're painting with a very broad brush, and if I can paint with a brush that's just that broad, I would say that the momentum of history is basically positive. It's not negative. The world is shrinking. We're seeing more institutions that allow the world to get along together, more people joining common organizations, no matter what their cultures, common organizations like the World Trade Organization. We're seeing more global institutions. The United Nations is becoming more useful, not less useful. And I think we're heading towards an era where perhaps all we have to worry about is the stray individual or group, which is a preferable era to constant divisions and global warfare.
I need to jump in because we're just about out of time, and we have maybe about a minute or so. The Bush administration obviously wants to make it look like they're taking the recommendations of the commission very seriously, and have been having meetings and talking about apparently what they can do to follow up on and to implement some of the recommendations of the commission. At the same time, people who know how slowly things can work in Washington politics, observing the fact that we're near the end of the session and we're coming up to an election, make it sound as if not very much is going to be done before the beginning of next year. Just generally, acknowledge the fact that getting things done in Washington is not easy. I wonder, do you have a particular feeling about just how many of the recommendations of the commission, particularly the ones that are really big, that we're likely to see come to pass?
Well, of the three big ones, reorganizing the Executive Department's counterterrorism processing center. Is something that Bush could do essentially with the snap of a finger and a lot of hard work to catch up to the policy. The others involving adding a new cabinet-level officer and rearranging budget procedures, and that would also take a rearrangement of the way Congress considers the intelligence budget, will take a lot more work. And I think what Bush and Kerry are both doing now is positioning themselves politically. It's very easy for Kerry to say, and he does, let's do everything, let's do it now, and let's keep the 9/11 Commission up and monitoring everything. And Bush, for his part, has to look like he's taking swift action on this. He doesn't want to have the issue turn against him. But I think, in reality, there's not a whole lot he could do immediately.
Well, I think that at that point we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. I want to thank you, Mr. Strasser, very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you.
Our guest, Stephen Strasser, teaches journalism at Rutgers University, and he is a former correspondent and editor at Newsweek magazine. The book, if you'd like to look at it, is The 9/11 Investigations, bringing together the staff reports of the 9/11 Commission with some excerpts from the House-Senate Joint Inquiry Report on 9/11 and some of the testimony of the key witnesses called before the 9/11 Commission. It's published by Public Affairs Books. Programs here on AM 580 made possible by grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at the genre of the science fiction film. I'm getting a signal here that I